from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a new movement on campuses around the country for warning labels on literature or research that describe racism or rape, anti-Semitism, violence, you name it. Trigger warnings, they're called. The push has hot defenders and hard critics. Either way, it's here, and depending on where you stand, we'll make the world a better place or a worse place. This hour On Point, trigger warnings on college assignments from Shakespeare to Huckleberry Finn. Later in this hour, a former Princeton University president is invited to give a commencement speech at Haverford College and chastises college protesters for pressuring a fellow speaker. First, the trigger warnings movement. Joining me first from Los Angeles is Jennifer Medina, national correspondent for the New York Times. Her story on trigger alerts appeared on Sunday in the Times. You can find a link to her story at our website, onpointradio.org. Jennifer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's not the first we've heard of it, but you pulled it all together. What's the movement, Jennifer?
Well, there's a few different things going on, but essentially the movement is to place something called trigger warnings in front of things that might either provoke students or by some advocates upset students. Anything from sexually explicit or sexually graphic violence to, some people have mentioned, Things Fall Apart, which talks about racism and other things. So it's a lot of different interpretations of the same thing, but the basic thing is warning students, this thing ahead of you might be something that is going to upset you in some way.
And the thing ahead of you might typically be a reading assignment, let's say, for the class.
Right. There's sort of two different strands of this. I think one part of it is reading. You know, the two basic things of college are reading and seeing, or in college courses. So one part of it is something you would read, any piece of literature, an article, anything like that. And a big part of it is also one of the things that students like to talk about is visual. I'm not sure that people outside of universities realize how much lectures use films and pictures and apparently more graphic things, at least than what I remember in college. And that's something a lot of students seem to be really agitated about.
You cite a number of particular pieces of literature that have attention here. And some of them, I mean, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn gets in here from Mark Twain, The Great Gatsby's here, Things Fall Apart, as you say, from Chinua Achebe. I mean, these seem like, yes, provocative in some dimension, but yet these are pieces of literature that have been read by college students for many years. What's new that people are asking for trigger alert in advance of wading in?
It's not exactly clear to me what's new. Certainly there's nothing new about the literature that you cited, but I think perhaps what's new is maybe two different things. One professor I spoke with, academic I spoke with, cited the whole notion that many students are used to these things. These things have been on the internet, have sort of existed. This notion of a trigger warning has existed for some time on the internet, and many of these students sort of grew up steeped in internet and social media world, so perhaps they're just used to it. Another theory is that these students sort of have been more coddled and want to sort of stay more coddled. There's a whole other strand, another part of this conversation for a lot of students is the whole conversation around sexual assault and PTSD on campuses. And so many of the students say, you know, this is another way that we should be grappling with and responding to students who have PTSD, whether it's from war or being sexually assaulted.
So what exactly is being asked here? As I read you, I don't see universities where this is required at the moment, but there's quite a list. University of Michigan, Oberlin College, George Washington University, University of California, Santa Barbara, and more. I mean, Wellesley in Massachusetts, Rutgers, New Jersey, Scripps in California, where there has been this push to have this kind of trigger warning in front of material that might be upsetting. Has anybody said, yes, this is the law of the land on our campus now?
No, certainly not. I mean, students across the country are talking about this in a whole variety of ways. For some, it's simply a blog entry or an editorial or some sort of, in very few places, a student petition. It's gotten the furthest at UC Santa Barbara and Oberlin, which are the two schools we focused on in the story, where there are actual policy proposals. At UC Santa Barbara, a student activist proposed this in front of the student government. The student government unanimously approved it, and asked the Faculty Senate to consider it. The Faculty Senate hasn't acted on it, and it doesn't appear that they will. And there's been sort of widespread, almost across the board, outrage from faculty members saying, of course, this is not something we want to do. At Oberlin, it came out of revising the sexual assault policy on campus, and they put up a proposal online that really wasn't seen by most professors until after it started getting some media attention. And then again there was sort of widespread faculty revolt, and it seems like it will be altered fairly dramatically. So this hasn't happened. This hasn't been actually enacted in any place, and given the hue and cry from faculty members who control the academics on campus, it's hard for me to imagine that it will actually happen.
But it's been pretty widely proposed at this point. I'm reading faculty response here, ranging from silly to antithetical to college life to reflective of a wider cultural hypersensitivity to harm. But you've got the Oberlin text here where they're saying, you know, let's have warnings when you're going to run into racism, classism, sexism, heterosexism, cissexism, ableism, as in with handicapped and other issues of privilege and oppression. That would be a pretty wide swath of warnings.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think there's many students who are calling for many different things, and I don't think that this is going to die down. And I think faculty and college campuses are really going to have to grapple with how they respond to it. And I think pressures will be different at different places. Outside the academic world, from most of what I've heard, has been a lot of condemnation. But there seems to be some sort of generational divide, I think, between many students. Many young people see this as something that is almost obvious. Like, why wouldn't we do this? And older people seem to be really worried about academic freedom and slippery slope and that sort of thing.
Jennifer Medina reported on the push for trigger warnings in college materials in the New York Times. Jennifer, thanks very much for joining us from L.A.
Thanks so much.
Let's go to a student who has spoken up for this. Justin Pellegri joins me right now, managing editor of the G.W. Hatchet, the student newspaper at George Washington University. Recently wrote an opinion piece in the Hatchet in favor of trigger warnings. Justin, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What's your argument? You know, a lot of faculty are saying, come on, you know, don't be hypersensitive. Get it together. People have swum in these waters for years and didn't need advance warning before they went in. You're saying, wait a minute. What's your argument, Justin?
Sure. Well, I should say off the bat, I understand that there are some faculty members who have that view. However, I have spoken to some faculty members at GW, where I go to school, who have actually been quite receptive to the idea of trigger warnings. Basically, the premise is this. Students walk into a classroom at age 20, but they've lived a whole life and they've had a series of different experiences before they enter the classroom. And the idea behind a trigger warning is to show some respect and some understanding that those experiences occurred. So, for example, a veteran who's in the classroom, which at GW there are a lot of veterans, and I know that's true across the country. Those students might have had experiences across, you know, across the country, overseas, that have been traumatic. A trigger warning letting them know that what you are about to see in a film or in a piece of literature could be somewhat disturbing sounds like the appropriate and respectful thing to do.
That a vet who might have a severe reaction wouldn't be blindsided by images out of battle or war, for example.
Exactly. Now, to be clear, I don't advocate for, and I don't want to speak for an entire group of people, but I don't think anyone else who supports trigger warnings would support removing that sensitive content from the classroom.
What about removing the student? The student saying, I can't watch this. I'm going to not read this or not watch this.
I mean, I think that's a choice that students should be given the option to make. I think, to be honest with you, most students wouldn't make that choice. All that they are asking is just the right to sort of be aware of what it is they're about to watch or read or consume before they do, so they have an opportunity to sort of emotionally prepare or maybe go online and Google the book or the film just so that they have some background so that they can put it in context before they consume it.
Justin, students have for forever, I guess, confronted sexual abuse or experience in war or lots of other trials and traumas in life before and during their time in college without trigger warnings. Why do you think this is an issue now? Why are students like you pushing for this now? Is there something generational happening here, something different about your generation?
Well, I think Jennifer was right in that trigger warnings are something that you often see online on blogs, and the hope is that that can also translate into classrooms. But also, you've seen a lot of advocacy, especially on the issue of sexual violence, which is another important issue for trigger warnings. On the national level, you've seen President Obama and numerous members of Congress weigh in on that issue recently. So I think because it's become such a national issue and because there are so many people trying to decrease stigma surrounding issues like sexual violence, post-traumatic stress disorder, homophobia, racism, whatever the case may be, advocates are trying to bring that into the classroom now. And I do think that's a good idea. The point is not to remove that information from the classroom. It's not to censor professors in any way. That would be counter to, you know, the whole purpose of us going to college in the first place.
Why not just say, take the attitude that college will be and should be challenging? So brace up, whatever your background, and just be ready.
Yeah, I think that that's a valid point.
But that wouldn't require a trigger warning.
I think that students have a right to sort of have a little bit of awareness before they walk into the classroom. I mean, if you were sitting at dinner with a group of people, you wouldn't bring up a sensitive topic without, you know, feeling out the room, seeing what people in the room thought about it. So I don't see why that same sort of respect can't be brought into the classrooms.
Justin, stand by in Washington. We're talking about trigger warnings, the push for warning labels on college material. Join us. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what are called trigger warnings on college course materials. Justin Pellegrin joins us. He's managing editor at the student newspaper, the G.W. Hatchett at George Washington University. He's written in favor of trigger warnings on school materials, and you hear his argument. With me in the studio is Rachel Tiffey. She teaches gender and communication, public communication, mass communication at Merrimack College in North Andover, Massachusetts, also supports trigger warnings in college syllabi and classes. Rachel, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
Why do you favor this? You've no doubt heard the pushback, people saying, come on, get off it. Who needs this? We didn't used to have this. Why do we need this now? Do we have a hypersensitive generation here? And yet Justin and others, we've heard how many campuses, you are saying, yes, we do. Why?
I definitely echo so much of what Justin said. I think the idea of preparing students and giving them more information rather than less is a goal of education and certainly not the antithesis or whatever that quote was about education. Providing them with more background knowledge about what they are about to engage with, I think, is part of learning, and that's and allowing them to make the choice so that they can better engage as learners and not potentially shut down if something traumatic has happened that would encourage that.
Why not just come into class with an intrepid attitude? I'm in college. I'm here to be challenged, to stretch my mind. Some of these things may hit my personal experience in a way that yes, I'm sensitive, but let's go.
I think the language around this, using words like challenged or sensitive, is not really what trigger warnings are really about. Being challenged in classes, finding material that you maybe feel sensitive to, I've heard definitely critiques from the sort of more progressive left-leaning side who critique trigger warnings, saying that, you know, white students who feel sensitive talking about white privilege or racism, that we shouldn't be sympathetic to that. And absolutely, that's, in my opinion, not what trigger warnings are about. It's not about protecting students from engaging with challenging material. This is really talking about trigger warnings stemmed from, as both Jennifer and Justin noted, more advocacy for victims of sexual violence and survivors of sexual violence. And so to have words like challenging and sensitive be equated with notions of trauma, I think is troubling and problematic. Trigger warnings are really about protecting people who might have serious traumatic histories with things, not just something that's challenging.
Of course, that's wide open to interpretation. I mean, you heard the list from Oberlin, you know, which goes from racism to classism to sexism to heterosexism to privilege and oppression. That's a pretty wide swath.
And again, I think that when Justin says that it's not about taking these readings or these films off of syllabi, I think that's true. Anybody who's thinking about questions of privilege and oppression, racism, cissexism, ableism, all of those things, anybody who's thinking about those issues doesn't want to avoid talking about them. That is not the purpose of trigger warnings. It's about fully preparing people with more knowledge and better understanding of what they're about to jump into.
Rachel Tiffey, stand by, and Justin Pellegrin in Washington. Lori Essig joins us right now from Burlington, Vermont, professor of sociology and gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Middlebury College in Vermont. She's quite critical of trigger warnings, had a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education that you can link to at our website, where she says, limiting ourselves to pretty images of rainbow ponies is not enough to know the world. Lori Essick, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You're tough on this. Why?
Well, let me just say, I think your quote was a little out of context there. I certainly understand people's concerns, and I'm certainly very sensitive to issues of privilege. That's what I teach. But the way this actually works in the classroom is to shut down conversations. So as a few years ago, 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, when I first heard a call for trigger warnings from my students, it was because I had shown some images of anorexic bodies next to some fashion models to show the similarity in a class on gender studies. And they approached me and demanded that a trigger warning be placed. And it confused me because at that point, given that we were discussing eating disorders in American culture and constructions of disordered eating, it seemed weird to me that I would have to also say, oh, I'm going to show these images now. And the effect on me was quite chilling because I didn't have tenure yet and these students were quite adamant. And it felt very very much as if the practice of demanding trigger warnings from professors, particularly on tenured professors, could have a chilling effect on what we're teaching in class. And the other thing that was confusing to me and remains confusing to me is I don't know what will trigger people, which is what the rainbow pony quote is about. Mm-hmm. Because all sorts of things can trigger people. This conversation might trigger people. Talking about triggering might trigger people. So given that we can't know what will trigger people and given the strange interaction in the classroom whereby untenured professors in particular are in a vulnerable position about it, I think that we need to have a different conversation, right? And a conversation that's about creating dialogue without censorship and creating dialogue without a set of demands that seem to me more one-sided than they need to be. I think we need to think carefully about the effect this could have on the classroom, the effect it could have on untenured professors, the effect on speaking with one another about difficult issues.
Justin says this isn't about censorship. Others have said the same, but I hear you saying it could amount to that. This chilling effect you're saying is that what? Some professors might not introduce the material in the first place because they'd have to deal with this.
Yes, and I think anyone who's ever gone through the tenured process, when you're untenured, you know what a vulnerable position that is. On the other side of it, at some level, it would not have a chilling effect on what I do in the classroom now, but I can imagine being a 30-year-old professor and being very, very careful so as not to create that atmosphere of students being angry. And again, not just that, the vulnerability of untenured professors and adjunct professors and contract professors, but also I don't know what will trigger people. I have been told everything from, images of fashion models to talking about pornography in a section on pornography. So if you're taking a course that's dealing with these things, if you're taking a course that's dealing with racism in America. I teach a course on white people in America. We're going to discuss some painful things. And you've entered that course willingly. They're not required courses. And so I do think that those of us who teach courses that deal with some of the more painful subjects in American culture or cultures elsewhere might find ourselves, especially in an untenured position, shutting down what we're putting out there.
Fuller context, Lori Essick writes for the Chronicle of Higher Education, rather than retreating into a world where our courses are reduced to viewings of My Little Pony, let's all put on our big girl panties or big boy tidy whities and face that world together. Let's talk about it, think about it, write about it, analyze it, and in the end, learn to engage fully with all of it, even those parts that cause us to curl up in pain and sob. Because that's what a real education requires, and limiting ourselves to pretty images of rainbow ponies is not enough to know the world. A lot of callers for all of you. Stephen in Williamsburg, Virginia. Stephen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
It seems to be that this is a solution in search of a problem, number one. But more importantly, when you went down Oberlin's list of, I don't know what would it be.
Racism, classism, sexism, heterosexism, and so on, yeah.
Exactly. Would it not be easier just to put a trigger warning on the exit door of every hospital for women leaving with a child? And then the child would be forewarned that life awaits them.
And life comes with all this. Justin, what do you say to that perspective?
Well, I think that's an interesting point. Actually, we do see trigger warnings. They don't actually have that title, but we do see trigger warnings across the country for all types of things. For example, if you're about to walk into a room or a movie with a lot of strobe lights, you're usually given some sort of warning in the event that you might be uncomfortable with that or that might make you have some sort of physical reaction. What we see here for trigger warnings, the reason that this seems to be, there seems to be a huge pushback, or at least one of the reasons, is because this all has to do with mental health. And that's not something you can see, and it's not tangible. And as a result, sometimes people struggle to think that it's not real. Professor Essig made an interesting point when she said that students approached her and asked her if they could put trigger warnings. And as a result, she felt concerned and wasn't sure what to do and ended up removing some of that content from her syllabi. And, you know, I think that's unfortunate because I think that that means that students won't have access to that type of controversial information. Students weren't asking for that. What students were asking for is just some sort of fair warning before they consumed the content. But they didn't give any signal that they weren't interested in consuming that content.
Lori, you write that what started out as a slow trickle of trigger warnings is now a tsunami. Are there really that many?
It's surprising just how many there are. And I think what perhaps Justin doesn't know is how vulnerable professors who don't have tenure are to student evaluations, student complaints to chairs and deans, and that sort of thing. So I think the idea that this won't have an effect on speech is naive at best, quite honestly, even though I totally understand that speech can have symbolic weight and it can even commit symbolic violence and speech isn't always free. I do think we have to be very careful about jumping to the other side of that, of filtering out all speech that could potentially be painful or harmful. I'm also really concerned about constructing students as potentially mentally ill. I don't think that conflating PTSD, which is obviously a real issue, is the same as every student in your room. If somebody has PTSD, they can go to the ADA office, they can bring a letter in, they can let you know what their issues are. But the idea that everyone in that classroom is potentially suffering from PTSD and could be triggered by an image seems to me to make PTSD a meaningless category and to actually diminish the real suffering that people with PTSD have.
Rachel, what about that view? If you've got a particular sensitivity, you know, raise your hand in advance, let the professor know, let it work the other way. Let the student take the initiative rather than, smearing trigger warnings all over the place.
So in my experience, and I want to say that I appreciate Lori's discussion of the vulnerability of untenured professors. I am one. I am a 29-year-old untenured professor, and so I certainly understand that position. But I have found that my students, so for example, this semester, I did a lesson on trigger warnings to sort of explain what they were before even getting into them. So in my experience, my students actually weren't actually familiar with them. I think some students may not know, some people, rather regardless of whether or not they're students, may not know how seeing things will affect them until it happens. So to have a theory, a framework to say, this is a thing that might happen if you have experienced these kinds of things in the past, sexual violence, whatever the case may be, to have a theoretical framework to place yourself into, I think is more empowering than it is victimizing.
But Lori writes about young women in particular. She says, I have faith that they are not delicate flowers in need of my protection, but rather strong beings who can learn to deal with their very real pain.
Absolutely.
Well,
and when I had a unit, a whole, you know, lots of discussion in my gender and communication class about sexual violence, I explained what trigger warnings were, and I said, if you have any reason to think that you may not want to do the reading for that week or whatever the case may be, come talk to me. Nobody came to me. I know for a fact, based on the statistics, that 1 in 4 women experience sexual assault, sexual violence, that there were women in my classroom that had been survivors of that, and yet nobody asked me to not do the reading. So I think they're not delicate flowers. I see it every day. I see them being resilient to it.
Justin, is there something different about your generation? Generations before have not had warnings like this and yet have survived. Is your generation more delicate, more vulnerable, more fragile? Or do you just look back and say, well, things were unnecessarily barbaric before and we can fix that?
No, I don't think that things were unnecessarily barbaric. I think that what you see in my generation, which is a positive shift that most in academia will agree with and rally behind, is that people more than ever, now more than ever, feel comfortable talking about controversial issues and are fighting to decrease stigma about important issues that affect numerous people in classrooms and not in classrooms. And this this trigger warning movement is sort of born out of that attempt to really put things in the open and put all of your cards on the table and say, this is what I bring to the classroom. I have a background as a veteran or as a victim of homophobia or racism, and or I am a survivor of sexual assault. So as a result, I want to let you know that, Mr. or Mrs. Professor, and can you please just let me know what the type of content is going to be in this class going so that going forward, I can have some sort of emotional preparation for that. And actually, I have found that professors have been very receptive to that. I know that there are some who disagree. A couple months ago in a classroom, we watched a film that was quite gruesome, depicted violent sexual assault, and students in the classroom were not warned before that was shown. And as a result, some felt uncomfortable. Now, nobody left the room. And I think that in the event that we had a trigger warning before it, also nobody would have left the room. Perhaps they would have Googled it beforehand to learn a little bit more about it. When I confronted the professor after the class and asked if she might mind going forward, just telling us a little bit about what we're watching before we actually see it, so we have an opportunity to learn a little bit more and put it in that context, she was extremely receptive, and that's actually exactly what she did from there on out, and I was appreciative of that. And I didn't really think that it was an inconvenience to her. She certainly didn't change the syllabus at all. She didn't remove certain pieces or add certain pieces to dumb it down or, you know, to take into account sensitive students or whatever the case may be. She simply had respect for the fact that students are coming from all different places and wanted to make sure that we all felt comfortable in her classroom.
You know, we've got such a range of response to this online. People that are quite supportive of this. Others, I mean, here's one saying, how about just put a warning label on the college application? I mean, danger, not all ideas expressed at this institution of learning will be in your fat, lazy comfort zone. This gets people hot under the collar. Lori, is there room here to be sensitive and yet vigorous, rigorous, robust in academic pursuit all at the same time?
Absolutely. And I hope that any student that comes into my classroom never feels discomfort as a human being.
Why not?
But, well,
I mean, why should
they
might
feel discomfort?
Isn't that part
intellectually
of education?
Well, as a human being, as opposed to intellectually. Of course, if you come into a class that's on racism in America, you're going to confront some ugly and horrible images. Do you not know that? If you come into a class that's on gender in America, you're going to confront some difficult images. Of course, they should know that coming in. I'm sorry, but the entire course should have come with a trigger warning. Obviously, if you're taking a math class and somebody shows a film with a rape scene in it, that seems to me worthy of contextualizing beforehand. But if you're coming into classes that are in and of themselves examining how power works in the United States or in the world, it would seem to me that you would know that those will have some very upsetting images and readings in them. And I don't understand why saying to people, this particular episode of South Park is racist and misogynist, would somehow make that better. That doesn't even make sense for an education. It would seem better for students to say right at the moment, that's really racist or that's really not racist. And then there's a dialogue about that.
Let's go right to Wendy calling from Boston. Hi, Wendy. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. You've asked why now about trigger warnings.
Yes.
And I would simply like to stress that these trigger warnings aren't exactly a new phenomenon. They're the latest manifestation of a trend in censoring, punishing, offensive or upsetting speech that's been going on for about 20 years and is reflected in very broad, really expansive speech and harassment codes on campus.
Is it good or bad? Where is it taking us, Wendy?
I think it's terrible. I think that we're training generations of students, and this is several generations of students now because this goes back to the early 90s. We've trained them not to value free speech in all its offensiveness, and we've trained them to believe, you hear this all the time, that free speech doesn't include a right to offend. And that's very dangerous for a democracy because free speech is unavoidably offensive. We don't have guarantees of free speech to protect the speech that nobody minds.
Wendy, I'll put that right into our conversation. I really appreciate your big sweep there. Let me get one more and we'll pick it up. Norman in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Norman, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that I am mostly
with Wendy on this. Are they going to have trigger warnings at Bob Jones University for the more racy parts of the Bible?
You mean, where do we go if it? I mean, it's all kind of in the eye of the beholder. Put it in a conservative evangelical Christian school, and you could have four trigger warnings on almost everything you're saying.
Yeah, and it just seems to me it's not just a free, you know, not just a free speech, but free discourse and civil discourse, and it's I don't know where it's going, and it seems to me that this is a right-wing version of the nanny state.
I don't know, right-wing, left-wing. I mean, it really depends where you start out here. There's plenty in rather liberal campuses who are pushing on this front. Norman, I appreciate your call. Let me bring Charles Mitchell in right here. He's executive VP at the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. It's a conservative free market think tank. Joins us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Charles was editor of The Counterweight, the school paper at Bucknell University, conservative paper there. He's been on our show now and then for some years now. Charles, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
What do you think about this trend, trigger warnings on college course materials, Charles?
Look, Tom, it's well-intended, and I certainly have every respect for the folks on the phone who are concerned for veterans and those who've undergone sexual violence. But let me just say this. Wrestling with great ideas should, by definition, make us uncomfortable. And to me, that's not just a point about free speech or academic freedom. That's a point about education. That's a point about the kind of society that we ought to live in. And that's why this is so concerning. I agree with the chilling effect aspect of all this. You know, the fact that it's well-intended does not mean that it will not be destructive. And I think this is destructive to the very heart of education. I also would say that Wendy, the caller a few moments ago, raised a very good point. And you made the point earlier in your discussion that sometimes in campuses, when these are being talked about, it's put under the aegis of violence. We just have to be very clear here. Words are not violence. Words are the lifeblood of what any good education revolves around, and it's incredibly dangerous when we even flirt with classifying words as violence. As you well know, Tom, a lot of folks say I would come from the right, so I take a different view from some of the folks on the show. There are many ideas that I don't want my children, who are very young, to hear. But by the time they get to college, I want them to be able to grapple with every idea. I think I agree with the caller who said the whole college experience ought to have a self described warning label on it. You should know that you're going to be uncomfortable when you go to college.
I want to circle around to the whole big free speech idea, but Justin, let me bring that notion to you. I wonder where you stand on it, that words are not violence. Do you agree with that, Justin, or do you hope in some part that trigger warnings like this and that the culture that produces them are actually easing some words out of our vocabulary?
Well, that would be extremely unfortunate if that is the case, and that's not what I or any people who support trigger warnings are advocating for. There's a difference between being uncomfortable in the classroom, which is a really important part of education, higher education specifically, and being unsafe and feeling unsafe. So words are not violence, but those words, if said in a certain way or, you know, presented, you know, in literature or in a movie or whatever the case may be, might remind a person of something that happened in their past that was traumatic. We understand that happens. That's why we're all, you know, we all talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. We've accepted that as something that exists in the world. And students in academia, in higher education, can be uncomfortable with what they're learning while still understanding that they are safe and still feeling like they're safe. You know, we've seen across the country this season in particular a series of very important Americans told not to come speak at graduations across the country because what they are saying is controversial. And that's a huge problem. That's not something that, you know, that anyone in higher education should stand for. But that's
some
not what
might say, Justin, that what you're proposing here is related to that. Wendy's saying as much in her comment that there's a chill, an attitude that's not accepting of the full range of freedom of speech, even in trigger warnings.
And I think that's unfortunate that there is that attitude, and I would not disagree with you. I would say that there is increasingly an attitude of students who feel that there are certain types of speech that if you don't agree with it, it shouldn't be part of the discourse. But I think that's extremely unfortunate. And to be clear, that has nothing to do with the trigger warning movement, which just calls for some basic respect in college campuses about what types of material students are going to consume.
Yeah, I'm not sure the line is so bright there. But Lori Essig, what about it? Do you think that college students ought to be guaranteed a sense of safe, intellectual and emotional safety in the college classroom? Is that part of the deal?
Well, I think in order to accept that deal, you have to accept that you have some huge number of people who are, in fact, able to be triggered. That is, they are suffering from PTSD. And I'm not sure that it's as widespread as the pro-trigger warning movement would
argue. But it's
not
limited to PTSD or post-war situations or sexual. We're talking here about privilege, about post-colonial.
Right, but the whole notion of trigger is that this will make them feel physically unsafe because they've seen an image or heard some words, which implies PTSD. And I don't think that that's true. I think what it makes a lot of people feel is uncomfortable and emotionally uncomfortable, intellectually uncomfortable. And that is a different set of concerns. As I said, if somebody suffers from PTSD, they should totally not feel triggered in my classroom or anyone else's. But to assume that everyone suffers from it or potentially suffers from it is to medicalize our students and make them these vulnerable subjects. And I'm not really sure why that is, although I have a feeling that your caller is right, that this is a longer movement. And I think the movement is well-intentioned. It's a movement that's saying, hey, speech isn't always free. Speech has effects. Free speech, like the free market, is more an ideal than a reality or even a lie. And that the words can have costs. I mean, we've seen that through the anti-bullying movement, right? Words have real effects. But to acknowledge that words have real effects shouldn't allow us to jump over to, so let's put warnings on everything. I think that that is a slippery slope. I hate to say it, but it is a slippery slope into censorship, into shutting down academic freedom, particularly among untenured and more vulnerable professors, which is increasingly who is out there teaching and who's going to be out there teaching.
One can imagine a narrower and narrower sort of field of comfort or safety. On the other hand, we hear the concerns that are raised. Sam in Arlington, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Sam.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I teach peace studies at Clark University, and I certainly use trigger warnings when I teach about a number of things, and it has improved the conversations in my class. For example, I teach Andrea Dworkin's amazing speech, I Want a 24-Hour Truce in Which There Is No Rape. And by including a warning about how powerful a speech it is and how angry it is and how intense it is, students are clued in to listen to their emotions and to share their emotions in class, and our intellectual discussion then also improves. So I think it's a way of acknowledging the emotional content of the material that we share.
But can it become at that level, Sam, a kind of spoon feeding? I mean, why not let people take it on, observe it, and come to their own conclusions about its meaning, its significance?
Which they do anyway. So it's not spoon feeding. It's not telling them what to think or how to feel. It's just acknowledging the intensity of the emotion so that they're better able to deal with it. And when I didn't use the trigger warning in the past with that same material, the discussion was really sort of derailed by the intensity of the material, and they didn't really grapple with the intellectual or the emotional content as well.
Interesting. Just a kind of a heads up to get them in the groove for that theme. Rachel Tiffy, where does this take us? Where are we headed? If this becomes more common, do students become generally feel safer or more comfortable? Is that a good thing? Is our classroom discourse, does it end up constrained for the very concrete reasons that Lori has laid out and you yourself may be sensitive to as a non-tenured faculty?
I think the notion of creating safety, Roxane Gay had a really good piece. She's a writer and feminist writer that talks about safe spaces is a myth. I mean, creating safe space in the classroom or in the world, that can't happen.
Isn't this an effort to try?
The idea of creating safer spaces, I think, is not a bad thing. And I think that's what trigger warnings are trying to do, safer spaces, or at least providing people with more context and more knowledge.
Why is safer space a goal?
Because
maybe unsafe space should be the goal to get us out of our zone of safety.
And certainly there are some admirable arguments for that sort of approach. However, I think that to have safer spaces, at least with more knowledge and understanding of what students are about to engage with, actually allows learning to flourish more, just like the caller said. Instead of being derailed from the intensity of the emotions, acknowledging that, that this is a thing that may happen and preparing students, I think, actually enables more interesting and challenging conversations. The exact thing happens that people who are against trigger warnings think is going to be shut down, I think is actually enabled through those warnings. And additionally, I think that teaching students that triggers are a thing that can happen to people who have experienced this kind of violence or trauma in the past actually enables a discussion of the reality of just how awful and brutal some of those experiences can be.
Somebody wrote medical infantilizing. You're saying, well, maybe not. Maybe it opens people up to a richer conversation. Charles Mitchell, where do you think we're headed here? Is this the United States of the future? Warnings on what we read, see, hear?
I think it's very clear that these take us down the wrong path. They're very well intended. You can see that even in the New York Times article that you quoted. There are very reasonable sounding explanations for why we might do this, but when you take it to its logical conclusion, you have these laundry lists like we see it at Oberlin. This is a dangerous principle. It's one that has no place, in my opinion, in higher learning. In fact, when I first read the New York Times article, I thought I was going to be reading about a grade school.
Charles Mitchell, I appreciate you being with us today. Rachel Tiffy, Lori Essig, Justin Pellegrini at George Washington University. In a moment, former Princeton President William Bowen speaks to the class of 2014 at Haverford College. Thanks to you all. This is On Point. This commencement season has seen a wave of protests against scheduled speakers, most notably IMF Director Christine Lagarde at Smith College, Condoleezza Rice at Rutgers University withdrew. At Haverford College in Pennsylvania, former chancellor at the University of California at Berkeley, Robert Bergenau, was one of four scheduled speakers, but withdrew as a speaker after some students and faculty wrote him a letter requesting he apologize and meet other demands for the forceful breakup of a 2011 student protest by campus police. At the commencement, former Princeton University president William Bowen confronted the college protesters for pressuring Bergenau with their list of demands.
Let me be clear at the outset. I am not judging the controversy over Bob Bergenau's handling of unrest at Berkeley. I have neither the facts nor the inclination to do so. I would suggest only that people interested in the cross pressures on a chancellor at Berkeley seeking to respond to extraordinarily difficult, testy demands should consult the brilliant memoir of a Quaker-inspired person, Clark Kerr, which recounts the choices he made with mixed results, as he was the first to insist in the mid-1960s. Second, I want to suggest, with all due respect for the venerable right to protest, which I would defend to the end, that it is a serious mistake for a leader of the protest against Bergenau's proposed honorary degree to claim that Bergenau's decision not to come today represents a quote-unquote small victory. It represents nothing of the kind. In keeping with the views of many others in higher education, I regard this outcome as a defeat, pure and simple, for Haverford. No victory for anyone who believes, as I think most of us do, in both openness to many points of view and mutual respect. I am reminded of the experience of Richard Lyman, another graduate of a Quaker-inspired college that I believe is located somewhere in this vicinity, who was president of Stanford at a time when he felt obligated to call in the police. Conservative alumni, who had been sharp critics of Lyman's liberal tendencies, applauded his action. But Lyman was having none of it. He replied that any time police had to be involved, as he resolutely believed was necessary in the situation he confronted, it was a defeat for the university, not a victory for anyone. There are no winners in such situations or in overly contentious replays of them. In this instance, I'm disappointed that those who wanted to criticize Bergenau's handling of events at Berkeley, as they had every right to do, chose to send him such an intemperate list of demands. In my view, they should have encouraged him to come and engage in a serious discussion, not to come tail between his legs to respond to an indictment that a self-chosen jury had reached without hearing counter-arguments. I think that Bergoglio, in turn, failed to make proper allowance for the immature and, yes, arrogant inclinations of some protesters. Aggravated as he had every right to be, I think he should be with us today.
Former Princeton President William Bowen, speaking at Haverford College in Pennsylvania on Sunday, he received a standing ovation from the Haverford crowd. To see a video and for a transcript of his address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.